G'day and welcome to Roaming with Lil. My name is Lil Deverell. I'm an orientation and mobility specialist based in Melbourne. I'm interested in anything to do with functional vision, orientation and mobility, and the research that helps us to do our job better. Today I'm talking with Tim Dyer, an organisational consultant based in Tasmania. Tim goes into toxic workplaces and communities that are not safe and supports people to work towards healing. I've asked Tim to help me explore the usefulness of personality models in this context. Hi Tim, tell us a bit about you.
Hey, good morning Lil, good to catch up with you. So a little bit about me, born and grew up in Tasmania and at the age of 17 left home, went overseas, spent a bit of time in the US. So my mother's actually from the US, so it was good to get into that kind of a space. Came back, went through Melbourne University, a bit of work at Monash University after that. Worked with homeless young people in Melbourne for a number of years, got married, went away overseas to do a bit further training, came back and raised four kids in Tasmania. That's a little bit about me.
You mentioned going to Melbourne University and Monash. Is that where you did your study in psychology?
Yes, I did an undergraduate degree at Melbourne. I'd always been interested in psychology after working with homeless young people, and one of my stints in the US was working with young offenders. And so I was involved in a program of rehabilitation for young offenders, and that got me quite interested in the whole area of psychology, and particularly healing and damage, repair from trauma. And so I looked at the various schools of psychology, decided to go to Melbourne, and then did graduate work at Monash following that. Yeah. So I remember the first lecturer in psychology in our, 550 in the class, and the lecturer stood up and said, "Most of you are here to sort yourselves out. We'll lose you by the end of first year or second year."
I love it.
Those of you who really want to work with other people and help other people, you'll see you in third year and fourth year.
So. Nice. That's very practical. What are you doing for work now?
Most of my time, I am involved in sort of one-to-one mentoring of people in leadership in various nonprofit organisations, particularly a religious sort of context. I train facilitators also for people that kind of facilitate work around organisational health and leadership development. I'm also involved in training consultants who work with organisational life. So again, particularly in a religious framework, but I think for me that has included over the time things like hospital chaplains, schools, a range of non-for-profit organisations that I've been involved in, both on the ground facilitating organisational health, but also training and supervising other people to do that work. Mm-hmm. A fair bit of my work was involved in the recovery of churches out of the Royal Commission situation.
Looking at paedophilia, looking at moving priests on.
My focus more so was on what damage did that do to a congregation of people and their capacity to trust their leaders, and how do they recover a sense of psychological and organizational health out of that process.
We'll come back to that later, that spectrum between super healthy mature workplaces and toxic workplaces. 20 years ago you came to my mum's group and gave us some sage advice about, doesn't matter which one, but if you learn a personality model, it gives you a language for understanding otherness, and you don't go through your parenting life expecting your child to be just like yourself. And I found this quite novel and good advice, and I've had 20 years to put it into practice. Would you still give the same advice to a group of young parents?
Absolutely. In fact, I'd be a little stronger even than I was back in those days.
Oh, what would you say?
Look, I think the importance of realizing that we just have a natural tendency as human beings to assume that everybody thinks and processes and deals with things in similar ways to we do. And when we move from that assumption to an expectation that people will, and then a judgment that if they don't, there's something wrong with them, or they think there's something wrong with us, it just creates such a level of confusion and conflict and misunderstanding. Just the capacity to realize that, wow, people are different. That's fascinating. That's really interesting. That's important. That's good. Let's now create some room in our hearts not to move to labeling and judgment and that is a cause of conflict, but to realize that can actually be an incredible gift to the way in which community functions, families function and operate. We don't have to be the same. And in fact, when we appreciate each other's differences, contributions, different skills and abilities, that can bring an incredible richness to life, to community, to family, to companies, to organizations, when we can understand where that comes from, how it works, and make room for it.
I feel like our profession in orientation and mobility embraces the otherness of our clients very well. We're good at person-centered practice when it comes to client work. Is it about transitioning that person-centered attitude to our buddies who share our office, to our line manager, to the CEO, and to look into the hearts of people maybe and say, well, what matters to you? What's motivating you? What lights you up?
Absolutely. You know, when we're dealing with people with a form of disability, we use a frame of reference to understand, accept, and extend a generosity of heart and spirit into that place to allow someone to be in a very different space to where we are. Sometimes we don't apply that across other areas of life. So we think that everybody who has this role must do this role in this way, with this set of approaches or this particular style of doing things. And so we need that same spirit of generosity and openness when we are dealing with people on a team to realize that we can do the same job in different ways. We can be different types of people in the same organization together. We can be together even though we see, process, deal with things quite differently to each other. So having that same generosity of spirit gives us the room to understand ourselves a little better, understand others a little better, and then make that connection between self and other, I think, a little more creatively and openly.
Looking at myself through a lens of disability, looking into ADHD is interesting because there's a dual tension there about purpose.
Yeah.
One purpose is to pathologize and do norm referencing, and that would be a medical model that says, how aberrant are you from what society decides is normal? And that's where we get things like the DSM that helps us to diagnose these things. So what's the point? Is it just about saying, well, you're not normal? Or the kind of lens through which we look at disability in the orientation and mobility context is more as a means of putting language around someone's particularities, their learning style, their subjectivities, because if we can name it, then it gives us access to a whole world of resources to know how to deal with that. Having branded myself ADHD, I can now Google all kinds of opportunities. I've got a Zoom group with some buddies that I get together with once a month. And it's very freeing to have a name to put on the person that I've actually been all along and know what we're dealing with here to know how to move forward in creative ways. Is that really what we're talking about with these personality models?
Look, I think it is, Lil. There's two things we can do with this process of framing or categorizing. Once we do it, I think it can actually be liberating if we have a mindset and an attitude towards it that says, this helps me make some meaning of it here. And the meaning is, I now know a little bit more about what to do, how to operate, how to treat others, and I can actually make some choices around using this constructively. So if we say, well, I'm an introvert and I work with an extrovert, and I can say, well, that's actually a good thing that I can understand that, because I know now the kinds of things why I feel a little bit, you know, put out in this particular environment when everybody's talking and I've got something to say, but I never seem to be able to get it in there and communicate. You know, I go home and sit down and write it all out afterwards. And I understand a bit about why I react this way. And I also can understand what this other person's needs are. So if we use the framing, if we use the categorizing in healthy ways, that's appropriate. We can also use it in unhealthy ways, which is to label and to judge. And if the meaning making in our mind says, because this person is not like me, they must either be stupid or less value, or they might dismiss me. And if we use it as a marginalizing or dismissing process, it becomes quite unhealthy. And so it's not just the capacity to frame and categorize, it's what we assume as human beings that means about us and about them. If it means, I am so thankful we live in such a rich world with so many wonderful, weird, crazy people. This is great, you know, and I'll enjoy hanging out with this person, and it helps me to know that they're an extrovert because I can just make room for that. And so if we approach this with an attitude that says, this just helps me in my relationship with this person to know these things, and it helps me act well and embrace them well, that's useful. If it causes me to judge, we're in trouble.
So it's like so many of the things that we have. Power, for example, it's not a good or a bad thing. It's how you use it that makes the difference.
Yes.
And it's how we see it through that can have damaging or healthy implications. How did you first become interested in personality models? What caught you by the throat?
Look, a couple of things. I've thought about this a lot over the years. So my mum and my dad are totally different personalities. And so I kind of grew up in a family with very different ways of thinking and operating. And in my growing up years, I was part of a number of groups of young people, you know, groups that ran camps, and we had lots of team time together doing lots of team things. So I wasn't a big sports person, but I was involved in a couple of sports teams. It occurred to me very quickly that people are very different to each other, and I should understand this as a part of that. And even from a fairly young kid, I ended up kind of in leadership sort of roles in things that I did. And I would be trying to work out, why would some people be more committed to this and some people struggle a bit more? What was going on here? And it was clear that it's not the only element, but one of the elements of just the personhood of people was their personality. And so that just got me a little bit interested in it. And probably one of the oldest books on my bookshelf is Eysenck's Know Your Own Personality. You know, I've got no idea when I first bought that from a secondhand bookshop or something. And so certainly when it came up at university in my studies, it was an area that I really found fascinating.
Yeah. There are so many different professional disciplines and industries that are now making really good use of personality models, not just my local breastfeeding association, mum's group. Can you define personality for us? What do we mean by personality?
Yeah, look, it's not an easy one to grasp, but I think people for a long time have noticed that there are certain common patterns amongst people in ways that people think, ways that they approach things like decision making, ways that they take in information and deal with things, the kind of orientation they have towards other people, that these aren't just simply random and individual for every single person. There are patterns around this that people seem to be of one type or another type. And this is observed right back to the days of the Greek philosophers. And then Shakespeare actually developed this a lot in his own plays that he wrote. He's got personality types that are woven through. And it's certainly become in recent times, since the advent of Carl Jung particularly, the idea that there is a sort of innate part of us that is reasonably stable over our life that governs the way we think and feel and act more or less. And we can deal with that as our personality. Everyone goes through different life experiences. We do have different worldviews, and that's different. That comes a lot from our family background. We have different family of origin, but there is a commonality that's common over cultures, over time, for people that we could call personality. And it's more or less a core element of our personhood that is reasonably stable over our lives.
Because it becomes intriguing with the nature-nurture issue when you look at kids brought up in the same family unit, but experiencing it so differently.
Oh, totally.
And then there's twin studies where twins are divided in their early years and they might grow up on opposite sides of the world and personalities run differently, and then they come back together and there's weird things in common as well.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that whole nature-nurture debate is intriguing. Have you seen that manifest in really curious ways in family units, for example?
So you have both. You have certain mannerisms and elements of culture that are transmitted even subconsciously through families. And people often say to me, goodness me, you know, even some of your hand gestures are so similar to your dad's. Or I live in a community that's got, as you know well, it's got kind of generations. And so people remember my grandfather. They will say, you just do things so similar to your grandfather. And he died when I was six. You know, how does that happen? And yet in the same family, growing up, as you pointed out, you can have people with entirely different experiences of the same family life. And they talk about it as if it was a different family. And somehow this is all processed through their own personality, their own frameworks. And so there are significant differences. And we do know that nurture plays a role. We know that nature plays a role. The actual balance, I don't know that anybody yet has really nutted it out. And your life experience that's independent of your own family plays a role too. You know, things like your schooling and your early friendships and all those things are important.
Back in those early mothering days when I was collecting stories for my breastfeeding book, one mum said to me, you know, parenting, I don't think you ever balance it. You just keep juggling. I loved that image because it speaks of dexterity and coordination.
Yes.
And it's dynamic and it's got all the pieces there, but there's no stasis.
No, exactly. And occasionally you drop the whole lot.
Occasionally you do drop the whole lot. So do we define personality, Tim, or do personality models define us?
Look, personality is only one aspect of who we are as a person. It's not the definitive thing. So you don't say to somebody, you know, you are, if you go into the Myers-Briggs, an INTJ, or, you know, you are a number four on the Enneagram or whatever it might be. That's one window with which we can look into a very complex, integrated whole person. And these provide a useful kind of frame of looking, but they don't ultimately define us. We're defined more deeply. We are not our thoughts. We are not our feelings. We are not our personality. Those are aspects of us. They are ways of understanding us. They're ways that help give us ways to speak about ourselves and describe ourselves. But at the end of the day, I think it's simplistic to say that we are ultimately defined by this, or that we define our personality itself. This is integrated. It does appear to be a core element of who we are. And so it's useful to explore and understand that aspect of ourselves. But it sits there alongside life experience and attitude and abilities. And we'll talk a bit later, I guess, about emotional intelligence. Those are different aspects of the human person. And I don't think anybody's got it kind of sorted out how all this integrates into one beautiful whole. And we can, you know, you have 63% personality and you have 20% life experience and you have 8% parental nurture. And I don't think anybody can do it. We are much more complex than that, but it is a valuable and useful window.
In our field, we talk about clinical vision and we talk about functional vision, clinical measures, functional measures. And the difference is that in a clinical context, you're stripping things back and looking at individual elements and building up from parts to whole with a more medical model, I suppose. And with functional vision or functional performance, you're looking at the whole person and then becoming curious about aspects of that person that warrant a little bit more attention or investigation and wondering. And so you go from the whole to examine the individual parts and to consider what element they play in the whole person that you're looking at. We need to look at the whole person and not lose that tension between the clinical and the functional. How have you found personality models useful in your work with churches or religious communities or other not-for-profits that have been wounding but also wounded?
Great question. I actually use it quite intentionally in my work, helping churches recover out of these situations. So one of the exercises is by asking people on a 1 to 10 line to indicate the level of emotional, spiritual, personal impact this event that has taken place in your community has had on them. And I'll describe what one looks like, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, in increasing levels of scale, like an emotional Richter scale, and then invite people to put their little object on the line that represents the level of impact they have experienced. And it's fascinating because everybody thinks, oh, this is a level 4 event and everybody should be at level 4. But when all those things go out, you find people from 1 through to 10. And when they talk about why they've put their situation there, all of a sudden people go, wow, everybody's experiencing this quite differently to the way that I have. And I invite people then to reflect on the experience of somebody further down the line than they are and work out how they would like to understand and respond to this person. And we've got another exercise where I just ask people, who do you care for? Where does your heart go in this circumstance? We put all kinds of people out symbolically on the floor and they pop their little objects out to where their heart goes first. And some people say, well, you should be caring for this person first. And somebody says, no, we should be caring for this. And all of a sudden we understand we're all processing this quite differently. I've often felt the anxiety in a room go down when people give permission for other people to be in a different space than they are. Personality is one factor of how that works, but life experience is another. You know, if you have been wounded, you've been through a situation of sexual abuse in your own life, and you enter a community where this happens again to other people, obviously this is going to raise an enormous amount of inner work for you in that environment, in that situation, which somebody who has not been through that is not going to experience. If you were very closely connected to this person and felt personally betrayed by their behavior, your experience is going to be quite different to somebody who just joined the community 3 weeks ago and only met them once. There's lots of factors that influence that. If you are, you know, have a personality that does need warm, close relationships with others, and you invested a great amount in your admiration of this person and they let you down, a different impact. And so all of these things just give permission for people to be in a different space, to accept that others are in a different space, to be generous in their reaching out and connecting with others in that space.
I heard a curious debrief on a bank robbery many years ago. Mm-hmm. One person was quite pragmatic and bounced back very quickly afterwards because they could see that no one was actually hurt and no big deal, a weird thing to happen that week, mm-hmm. by all means. Whereas another person was showing all the symptoms of PTSD. And when they were looking into that, it's because the second person had visualized everyone being shot down into a bloodbath.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And even though that wasn't what happened, it was what happened in the person's imagination. And so it was as raw as if it had happened in reality. Some people's heads go there, other people's heads don't.
Exactly. Yep. And that's a good example of where personality would impact the level of emotional trauma that a person might experience. So some people do have that innate ability to visualize. They can actually move themselves into that kind of zone. So most of the personality theories have an element of personality that has that big picture, visionary sort of approach to life. And others simply deal with the facts of what they can actually see in front of them, and their life is governed by their perception of the realities of the facts. So we might call that an idealist versus a realist, which is part of the Myers-Briggs process, an openness to experiences, which is part of the Big Five. And so a person's level of doing that is going to impact the kind of the way that they're traumatized by something.
You've dropped a few tasty morsels in there. Mentioning Myers-Briggs, I mean, there's type A and type B personalities, which I think comes down to if you're a control freak or pretty cruisy. There's the Enneagram. You've mentioned Jung. And did Jung pick up on ancient Greek stuff with sanguine, choleric, melancholic, phlegmatic? Where does that stuff come from? I feel the need to cough up catarrh when I think phlegmatic.
Actually, I mean, you're right on the money there. Because they call that model the four humours, which has to do with four bodily fluids.
If I say I'm feeling a bit liverish today, which would that be?
Yes. Black bile is more the melancholy. Apparently that one goes right back to three Greek philosophers. Hippocrates was one, and Aristotle was one. I think Galen was one. So that was picked up by Shakespeare in particular, and that becomes a basis for Shakespeare's kind of personality model. And then it's been popularised by different writers over the years. It's probably overly simplistic. It was connected to earth, wind, fire, water, and then connected to hot, cold, wet, dry. There's kind of a model around all of that. Well, we probably wouldn't be in that space today scientifically. Jung was a scientist, and so he first began to understand that people had different motivations for doing things. So his model has matured into the Myers-Briggs MBTI, the temperament sorter. Heaps of literature on that. It's quite a good model, but it still doesn't quite stack up scientifically. The more recent work that's been done is really around the Big Five. And since in the last 10 to 15 years, now called the Big Six, they've identified a sixth element of personality. So that's called the Hexaco model, Hexaco. And you can type that in and have a look at it. So it's these are a bit more scientifically rigorous in that it's a technique called lexical analysis. And so what they do is they just look at thousands and thousands and thousands of descriptors of people and people's patterns of, and they work out what words and descriptions sit clustered together. So what are the patterns that exist here? And now with pretty sophisticated computer technology called factor analysis, you can actually work out how many factors are there in personality when we use mega data. to do that. And so the most recent work locks that down to 6. And that's the classic big five plus an extra one now called humility, interestingly enough.
Humility. Now, that is a foreign concept to me, Tim. But the big five, ocean or canoe, yep. are our mnemonics.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
So yeah. we're talking yeah. about openness for O.
Yes.
Conscientiousness yep. for C. Extroversion yes. with its flip side, introversion, of yes. course. Agreeableness.
Yeah.
And neuroticism, yes. and you're saying that the yep. sixth one is humility.
They've just modified just a few. So the neuroticism one, now one becomes called emotionality in the new six. So H for humility, and then the others are all the same. The X is the extroversion.
Interesting. When we're talking about scientific rigor, that's probably a really good one to look at in grouping and categorising. Does that make the other models redundant?
No, not at all. It depends what you use it for. So if you're going to use this for scientific research, which a lot of papers do, obviously you want a model that's going to stand up with some scientific rigor. If you're using this to do a bit of self-understanding and understanding of other people, the purpose is not scientific rigor. If it's done with an open heart, the purpose is to help me be a better, to relate to people more carefully, to take more consideration of others. I don't think it matters really what model you use. If it's going to lead you in the direction of being a little more open to the unique way others might deal with things or think about things, if you can attend to others' needs more constructively, if you can share your own needs more helpfully in a situation, it's about human relationships. And it doesn't really matter, I think, how clear the model is, and pretty well anyone will do. Now I'll share something about myself. So I work best under pressure. Give me 3 weeks to do a job. The energy I require to do that job probably arises in me in the last 2 days of the 3 weeks. And I'll produce a pretty good report at the end of that right on time. But ask me to do it 5 minutes after I've got the job and I just don't have the energy to get into that. Whereas other people, the moment they get a job, everything goes in to getting this finished. And if they finish it 2.5 weeks ahead of schedule, they can relax and enjoy life and get on with doing things. It's just a different way of processing and dealing with things. Now, if we know that about each other, they get really annoyed with me. The longer they see me not doing the job, their anxiety levels is going up. And I've got to just be aware that that's an impact I have on other people.
Yeah.
But similarly, you know, I see them getting down. I think, you know, get a life. Let's go and bushwalking for a day. So I've got some energy to sit down and write this report.
lights you up.
Yeah. We do these sorts of things. And so just learning how to adapt to each other becomes valuable.
What personality model do you find most useful to position yourself when you're doing your own reflection?
Mm-hmm. That's good. Good question. Look, most of my experience really comes out of the Myers-Briggs one. So
tell me what you are.
I'm an ENFP. So, yeah, extroversion, intuitive, slightly more feeling than thinking, and P, which is more open-ended, like likes to have lots of options on the table, doesn't necessarily like to have everything organised and settled in life.
I think people are familiar with the introversion, extroversion thing, and it's not just about how social you are, it's where you recharge your batteries from,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly, yes, that's right. It's where you get your energy, yeah.
Yeah. So I have been known to come home from an 8-hour working day to my husband and children, cook dinner, then turn around with a cracking headache and go and teach a breastfeeding class at the local hospital and come home bouncing off the walls because the whole process of being the centre of attention and having the answers to people's questions is so validating. And I love being in that place where I share information and the lights go on and I actually feed off people's energy in the room.
Yeah. It's a myth about introversion, extroversion, that extroverts do relationships better than introverts, and they don't. Both are capable of doing relationships. They do it in different ways, but a different transaction is happening. So at the end of a day like that, an introvert would be absolutely wiped out. You are energized by that process. but lock yourself away in COVID for a period of time, turn your cameras off and deny you any human interaction, you're probably struggling and finding it quite challenging and difficult, where some introverts have actually got their energy is increasing over that time.
As a raging extrovert, what's been life-giving for me during COVID is creating an intentional community. So I haven't left my relationships to chance. I am married to someone and have been for 30 years who needs approximately 5 minutes of my attention every day. That's how introverted he is. And so I have to go elsewhere for my social buzz. And so I have not left this to chance. I have about 8 weekly appointments in my schedule that are walkie-talkie appointments. I put on my Bluetooth headphones and I step out the door and I walk, and I'm committed to these time slots with particular people, and every conversation we have each week deepens that relationship as if I'm having a cuppa with my next door neighbour. And it's taken away the need to be geographically proximal. It's allowed me to choose my extended family, if you like, my community, and invest in it in a way that I might have done by moving in with a particular group of people or sharing a household or choosing to live in the same town as people that I wanted to share aspects of my life with. The difference between doing that and leaving those conversations, those phone conversations, to an ad hoc or, oh yeah, we must have coffee one day, is extraordinary. It's absolutely life-giving. And it stops me from being a sad bunny in isolation. I just feel connected and loved by people.
Yeah. Zoom is an extrovert's best friend in COVID period. You know, I've taken to Zoom like a duck to water. I love it. I would have 4 or 5 Zoom sessions a day with various people, and it's been a lifesaver for me. In fact, it worked very well for me because I can still get out and do things in Tasmania, bushwalking and other bits and pieces. And then within minutes, I'm having a fairly deep and meaningful conversation with somebody I would normally have had to been in Sydney to do before, but now I can do it all from home. Loving it.
Interestingly, as an energizer bunny, Zoom on its own is not enough. I love the visuals. I love the color. I love the intimacy of going into someone's bedroom or their study and I find myself looking at things on the bookshelf. But this framework of relationships, intentional relationships that I have, only one of them is a Zoom one.
Yes.
I need to engage with life kinesthetically. It's the ADHD thing. I need to have a busy body. So I get my steps up. I've got my 7,000 steps a day goal, and I try and walk and talk. And there's something about engaging in those relationships for a busy person that likes to learn on the move that combines the intimacy of those conversations and the bizarre privacy that comes from walking out in public and having a personal conversation with my headphones on as if no one can hear me. And it's about just choosing carefully where I walk and being mindful that other people might be listening in. But the intimacy of that commitment to a weekly building up of relationship, it's so very different to sitting at home feeling lonely and isolated and just sad because we're not allowed to go out and talk with people.
Totally. I totally get that. That's great.
That's the introvert extrovert thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Yep. If we talk about being sensing or intuitive, how do you define those differences in MBTI?
Yeah.
Is that about being a sensory junkie?
Not entirely. No. So in the MBTI framework, this is around how we take in information. So how do we gather things to ourselves before we start to process them, which is the next dichotomy in the MBTI. So do we take in things through a kind of intuitive process? So we pick up the patterns, we pick up the kind of the big picture of something, what's going on here. It's in the intuitive thing is the capacity to walk into a room and kind of pick up the vibe around what's going on. You look at a house on a hill and you think, oh, I could live in that place. That's what a view. You know, you can imagine yourself sitting in a hot tub on the deck with a glass of wine, and you've got a whole life that's just unfolded by looking at a house. A person that's an S deals with facts and realistic debt. They look at the house and think, how much would that have cost? I could never afford that.
The deck needs painting.
Yes. And what color? You know, and if they asked an intuitive person what color was the house, intuitive person would not be able to tell you They could tell you what it was like to live in it, but they have no idea of the actual, you know, could, how much would that have cost? How long would it have taken to build? It's all of those. The factual person picks up the facts around things and processes things in time and money and detail and has a very realistic understanding of things. And they'll tell you roughly when that house was built, how long ago, who, they'll tell you all kinds of details around it all. But had they ever imagined what it would like to live in it? They just don't go there.
It's almost that tension between the clinical functional. It's the parts to whole, whole to part. Yes. So you're saying the intuitive thing kind of gets the snapshot of the overall result and doesn't get bogged down in the details. But the sensate is more drawn in, attracted by those details, like beads to a honeypot.
They will pick up colour, size, time, details. It's called sensory because they process through the five senses, whereas the intuitive processes things a little more through that sense of, well, I'm picking up a vibe here around this. So they'll describe things like beauty and things like the feel of something, the sense they get out of it in terms of the way in which it says something to them. So they'll tell you a great story about something. It may be no reality to what they've seen. It's what it prompts in their imagination. And so they're often said to be visionary, imaginative people, as opposed to people that deal with the facts here.
So you're suggesting that Dennis DeNutto in The Castle, when he referred to the vibe of the Constitution, might have been an N on the Myers-Briggs.
I've never kind of sat there and watched The Castle and thought that, but just looking at other things, I think about The Castle. It's a great movie.
It is a great movie.
Yeah, that would certainly be characteristic of that kind of way of approaching. It does cause conflict between people who are very strongly on the S compared to very strongly on the N.
It brings me back to conversations about technology, and we've been having lots of those in these podcasts, but the idea of technology being intuitive or not, it never is for me, and I always just need step-by-step instructions. I need exactly what goes where. I think I'm a bit more of a sensate than intuitive when it comes to technology. And can you be more one thing in one aspect of your life and more another in another aspect of your life?
Look, it tends to be common across most areas of life. Your little illustration there is actually the next one, which is logical process. And so that's the T and the F. Difference.
Thinking, so, feeling.
Yeah. And so the step-by-step instructions that people love is typical of a T kind of approach. And so that's the need to have a logical step-by-step frame of getting from point A to point B, that it makes sense in terms of process. Mm-hmm. And that's typical of a T element. The F element, this is the person who makes exceptions for people always. And so you're not really concerned about the principle involved as much as the best thing to do here is to be adaptable, to be flexible. Let's just deal with this on the basis of what a person needs. And so if that means I've got to break the rules in this situation, I'll break the rules in this situation, because it's more important to meet the needs of a person than it is to follow the rules. Mm. A typical T person would say, you just can't live like that. If you do that, you're not going to help and serve anybody. We have rules for a purpose, and that's because they're the best for people in the end. You know,
why does this sound like dinner time conversations in our household over who's breaking the rules with COVID?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the rules are there for a reason. They help society. They help people. If nobody follows them, then we're all in trouble. But the other person said, but they don't work for any individuals. You know, every individual is got a unique situation, and we've got to respond to the needs of the individuals. That's much more the F person. The T person is the logical thinker who basically believes with full justification that logic will save the world. The F person says, yeah, but the world we've got to save is full of people and none of them are logical. And we all have elements of both, obviously.
But yeah.
We have a preference or a tendency to go one way or the other.
Yeah. And then there's the J and the P, the judging and perceiving at the tail end of the Myers-Briggs model. Yeah. Now, I have just learnt to think about this as people who are decisive with a tidy mind, being the J people, they come to decisions quickly and they don't regret them largely. They're just happy to make the choice and live with the consequences, and it's clear. Then there's the other people who are the P people. And one person in my life said, come on, Lil, it starts with D and it rhymes with zither.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. That's me. Yeah. I can dither at any time. Yeah. I can put off decision making.
Yes. Yeah. It's also about anxiety. So a J person has anxiety when the decision is not made. And so they basically sit there feeling anxious until we make the decision, and then we know what to do. We can do it. The P person feels anxious once the decision is made because they feel that they could have made the wrong decision. There might be other new information coming. Why would I make a decision when I don't have all the information and all the options? And let's not make this decision too quickly. Let's gather, let's organize, let's think about all this stuff. Let's pull all of it possibly together. And the moment the decision is made, they feel anxious, because it could be the wrong decision and they've committed too early.
Or you might miss out on something, that whole FOMO thing, fear of missing out. Oh, because once you settle in on one thing, all the other things aren't possible.
In the Myers-Briggs kind of analysis, and this is what Jung's first, because Jung came up with the P and the J first. They were the first things that he identified. And so the P actually relates to that second set, the intuitive and the sensing. So it basically says that if you're a P-type personality, then the intuitive or the sensing will be the stronger element of what's going on in your life. If you're a J-type personality, the T and the F will have a slightly more dominant role in your life and thinking. So the J is the deciding, decision-making thing. And so you'll tend to orientate more strongly to either the T or the F, depending on which one you are. If you're a P, you'll orientate more strongly. So for me, being an ENFP, so being a P-type personality, the intuitive thing is much more strong in my personality than either the T or the F.
You can dither over the vibe of the constitution.
Absolutely, yeah, big time.
So back to your initial challenge to our mums group, Tim.
Yeah.
You like the MBTI. You've lived with it a long time. A lot of people have come across that in the workplace.
Yes.
There's the Enneagram. Yes. Which is a different model, which we won't go into right now.
Yep.
There's the ocean model. There's the disc model. There's the basic A and B personality.
Yeah. Yep.
You reckon it really doesn't matter? Just choose one, go and make friends with it and see if you can use the language to understand yourself and other people better.
Any of them are useful. So they have different kind of emphases. They have different histories. They have different literatures that are written about them, and they're used in different ways in the contemporary world. I wouldn't want to be dismissive. They all have value. It depends a little bit on what you want to do. So I use the MBTI quite extensively in teamwork. I'll probably over time migrate into this new Hexaco model. I think there's some work to be done on that. I think it's got a lot of validity. It certainly picked up a couple of things that are not present in the MBTI. But I do a lot of work with teamwork. One of my favorite little documents is just what I call working with opposites. And it's, if you're an introvert, how do you work thoughtfully and carefully with an extrovert? If you're an extrovert, how do you take note of what an introvert needs? And the same with each of those other dichotomies. Just got the 8 boxes down and a series of dot points on. And I just go through a team. Everybody identifies who on my team are introverts, who are extroverts, who are intuitive people, who are the details people, who are the J's, who are the P's. And we write their names down. And then we just say, if you're a J and you're working with a P, what do you need to keep in mind? If you're a P working with a J, what do you need to keep in mind? What's important to each other? What values do each other have? And so any of them can be useful if we're using it to grow the capacity that we have to relate, to understand, to reach out and to connect with others well.
And it's a fundamental attitude of respect for otherness, isn't it?
It is, yeah. That's really what it comes down to. Whatever framework you use to define that otherness or categorize it, if we're using it to gain insight into how we can work thoughtfully and intelligently in groups, you know, so I can actually make adjustments to my way of doing things because I know how my way of doing things impacts other people.
Yeah. Tim, you've given us insight today into personality and the delightful ways that we can use it to learn about ourselves and other people. A tool for empowerment if you're stuck between a rock and a hard place at home and we're out and about and when we're trying to get a job done with people. Thanks for your contribution today.
Pleasure, Lil. Great to talk with you.
I've listed the personality models we've talked about today in the PowerPoint on my website, www.lildeverell.net/resources. If you're not familiar with any of them, then your challenge for this week is to pick one and find yourself an online quiz that helps you work out where you fit in the model. If you already know, then your challenge is to watch the castle, get the vibe of the constitution, and work out where Dennis Denuto fits in your favourite personality model. Ponder that as you keep roaming.